We got through Deuteronomy chapter 20, which means we're going to pick up with Deuteronomy chapter 21. It'll help if I actually turn there too. Deuteronomy 21, the first part of the chapter, verses 1 through 9, describe an unusual ceremony. I'm not going to read through all of it, but it does say, if anyone is found slain lying in a field, so you find a dead body. Oh, somebody killed somebody, but we have no idea who. And that's the premise, okay, you know, CSI has come on, all our best top detectives, and nobody can figure out who's responsible. But still, something needs to occur to show that sin brings a penalty, even if we don't know who, what individual should. And it seems that that's the underlying basis for this. You know, you don't know who killed him. Then your elders and your judges shall measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding city. So who's going to take responsibility in a corporate sense? Well, the nearest town. Not to say that they did it. Nobody's going to be put to death for this. But there will be an unusual type of sacrifice, as I said, to remind us that there is a penalty and God knows who did it. He'll ultimately take care of that for us. So once they do that, the elders of that city, the one that's closest, bring a heifer down to a valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown. The idea is a deserted place that's not cultivated. It doesn't tell us why here, but one speculation, which I think is a good one, is this is going to make the area where they do the ceremony ritually unclean. So let's choose a deserted place that nobody's using since it's going to become unclean. You know, when we got the water running, so the priests and the sons of Levi, they come near, and, they'll break the heifer's neck. This is unusual in that they don't slash its throat and pour out the blood. And, again, I don't have really a reasonable explanation, but it seems that God wants to make this different from, you know, the other ones where you do know who's responsible. And so they do that, and the leaders of the community wash their hands there in the valley. Washing the hands, you know, as in the case of Pontius Pilate, remember when he says, I'm innocent of the guilt of this man, when he's condemning Christ to be crucified. It's a symbol of innocence. Doesn't mean that the person washing their hands always is innocent. I would say Pilate, you know, he said, I'm not responsible, but he's the one that condemned him, so he had some responsibility there. By the way, Matthew 27:24 is a reference if you want, you know, I think all the synoptic gospels list that. But the answer is, in verse 7, they'll answer, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Verse 8, provide atonement, O Eternal, for your people whom you have redeemed. So the idea is God is the one that provides the atonement. No animal does. The animals are just symbolic of that. And verse 9, so you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood. Well, I should have finished the last of verse 8. Atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. So the price needs to be paid. We don't know who. So as a corporate body, a group, we're going to take responsibility, all the while acknowledging that it's truly God who provides the atonement. And so this was part of their system. Do we do this today? No. You know, we're not in the same ritual system or the civil system, but it's worth looking at these underlying things, the principles that even if we don't know who's guilty, someone is. Their responsibility needs to be taken. And, you know, I would say if any of us individually are responsible, we should take responsibility, but that's getting into another matter. Okay, we move on from there. Actually, it could be a chapter break, but I'm guessing they didn't want to make the chapters too short, because verse 10 goes into something totally different, as Monty Python would say. Now for something completely different. I don't know if any of you guys have ever watched. Some of you have, yeah. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them captive. So this is outside of Canaan, where you're killing everybody. Remember earlier we mentioned cities outside of that area, you might go and proclaim peace, and they could surrender and become tribute. Or if you fight against them, you'd kill the men, but not the women and the children. This seems to be that particular case. So you have some captives, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman. And you desire her and would take her for your wife. Okay. Sorry, I see somebody seeing this. Ooh, look at her. You know, face it, men are, men and sometimes women are visually motivated. Okay, this is making a way to do that. You know, and notice it does say taking a wife. It's not rape and pillage and plunder, which is good. Matter of fact, this legal procedure seems kind of weird to us, but I would say it's a huge improvement over pillaging, plunder, and raping and killing the women. Yes, Emily? Oh, okay. Were you just being preemptive or? Okay. So anyways, and I've got a couple points I'll make on this, but okay, you see her, you'd like her to be your wife, here's what you got to do. You can bring her to your house, and she has to shave her head and trim her nails. By the way, shaving the head is pretty clear what it means. The Hebrew for trim their nails, the scholars say they're not very clear. Some say it might mean exactly the English translation, cut the nails short. Others say that, no, you got that backwards, it means let the nails grow long. And some have speculated that it means something else, like painting her nails a particular color. Yes, Charlie?
Shave their head. I thought they were forbidden for women were forbidden from shaving their heads because it looks masculine.
Yeah, well, this is a one-time temporary case. Thing, so it's not a permanent. And I'm going to speculate on why, even though this doesn't say why. And matter of fact, I'll mention some people have speculated that it's a public symbol of this woman becoming a proselyte. Others have said it's a ritual of cleansing. There's another ritual in the Bible where, upon its completion, shaving the head is done and shaving all the hair. Anybody remember what that is? Taking the vow of a Nazarite. During the vow, the hair may not be cut. At the end, you shave it all off and you burn some of it on the altar. So there are some rare occasions when hair is shaved. We typically think of men taking a Nazarite vow, but it does specifically say that women could. This, by the way, doesn't say she's taking a Nazarite vow, but perhaps there's some relation. Like I said, maybe symbolic of some type of cleansing or being devoted to God. It's up in the air. We don't know. As a matter of fact, the other point I'll make is it's obviously foreign peoples. The Israelites are fighting against them. They conquer them. So this seems to be, you know, and I'm making this point because there are some that say the Bible forbids any type of interracial marriage. And, you know, I have said that I think commonly we don't encourage interracial marriage, but this seems to be a case of saying, okay, someone who's not a descendant of Abraham can be brought into Israel. They could be black, brown, red, whatever. It doesn't distinguish. The Bible does talk about not having pagan wives. You know, Exodus 34:16 is one of those. Exodus 34:16, Ezra chapter 10, verse 10. But this, you know, this seems to be saying, okay, this is regardless of whatever ethnicity she has, you can bring her in, and she's got to shave her head, trim her nails, put off the clothes of her captivity, mourn her father and mother for a full month. After that, once you do all that, then you can go in and be her husband, and she'll be your wife. And if you have no delight in her, set her free. You can't treat her brutally. You can't sell her for money. Huh. Okay, so as I said, it's a procedure. It seems to have symbolic value. Do you think there's any other basis of why you do this? And this is, I'm going to share just my guessing. But part of me thinks, okay, I said, the guy's, oh, look at her. Oh, boy, she looks great. I want to take her in my house and marry her. Okay, let's see how great she looks once we shave off her head and make her wear this particular set of clothes. And you got to wait 30 days. Maybe you'll change your mind. You know, it's easy for people to, on the spur of the moment, oh, I got to do this. And then you have some time pass. You know, she's not looking so great. You know, it doesn't say if she's not wearing her makeup or anything. But, you know, part of me says this might be also God's way of providing what I would call a cooling off period. There's a built-in delay so that the spur of emotion and whatever is allowed to pass. And during that time, you can think, okay, I really do want to take her in and make her my wife. Or you could say, I changed my mind on this. And you can let her go. Okay, so this is my speculation, but I kind of like that idea. A lot of people get fired up on emotion and such and do things short term, whereas a little time to consider and think can be valuable. Yeah, Charlie?
I can see that point. But it says that he's going to go into her, then become, you know, they're going to become husband and wife.
Yeah, and he can send her out after. Yeah, so I was making the option that he could choose to let her go before going into her. But this shows the option that he could afterwards, which to me would be, a less honorable thing to do. And by the way, my particular interpretation I'm adding to that is only my interpretation. So I want to be clear. I think that's a likely additional reason besides whatever ritual symbolism, but the Bible doesn't state that. It doesn't state anything against it. There's something else. Some people say, what if you already have a wife? How much does the Bible support polygamy? There's examples of it, and I'm asking that question because of the next section we move into. Verse 15, if a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, what'd you marry the second wife for if you didn't love her? Well, apparently people fall out of love, so they say. But if they have both borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, if the firstborn is of her who is unloved, it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons, he must not bestow a firstborn status on the loved wife in preference to the son of the true firstborn, the unloved. But he'll acknowledge the son of the unloved wife by giving him the double portion. And this is building on the custom that was already there. The firstborn would get a double portion and things like that. And let me back up, because a lot of the discussion on this centers around polygamy. Some Hebrew scholars, and I don't think it's unanimous, but some have suggested that this could be translated in verse 15, if a man has had two wives. And if that's a possible translation, that puts a different spin on it, because you can have had two wives sequentially. You're married to one, she dies, and you get married again, and you have children by both. You say, I really like this second wife. I want to make her son my firstborn. And this is saying you can't do that. You can't choose your favorite and use emotion or anything like that. You have to choose the actual firstborn, whether it's of the wife you love or a wife you don't love. If that translation is true, you could say, well, Israel's law isn't condoning polygamy. But that's only a possibility. Some scholars say, no, Israel's law definitely seems to allow polygamy. We could say it never condones it. It never encourages polygamy. And everything we've read in the Bible so far shows, boy, that's a bad idea. Just don't do it. Don't be foolish. Of course, in the United States today, you're not allowed anyways by the civil government, because as bad of things as the government comes up with, outlawing polygamy was a smart one. Yeah, Charlie?
I don't agree with polygamy, but if the state did allow it, is that a sin according to God? Because we obviously know Abraham had more than one wife.
Yeah, it's a good question. There are places in Africa, we teach that the Bible doesn't condone it, that it's wrong to do. And we go back to creation. When, Genesis 1, 1 and 2, God he made one man, he made one woman. And when the Pharisees asked Christ about divorce, in Matthew 19, verses 1 through 9, I've got it noted here, Jesus said, look, what God created is what he intended, one man for one woman. He never intended polygamy. He never intended divorce. But Christ said, Moses, for the hardness of your heart, allowed divorce. It seems that maybe God, for the hardness of their hearts, knowing they didn't have his spirit, allowed polygamy. But for those who have his spirit and can be like God or close to that, he'd say, no, don't do that. We're reading in some things here, but I think it's valid. Certainly, when we get in the New Testament, we don't see examples of people in the church practicing polygamy. And in the case of the patriarchs in the Old Testament, we never see them doing it with any success or happiness. Again, we could wrangle and debate, and I know you're not endorsing it, but those are valid questions. And I feel sorry, Mr. Dean deals with people in Africa where it's a question, it's not just a theoretical, it's real. Someone might be called into the church and, hey, I got these three wives, what am I supposed to do? Well, that's difficult. And he's not here, you'll have to ask him. They go through, basically they say, look, you got to get it down to one wife. In some cases, they still have to support the others. They have that responsibility, but you don't maintain a marital relationship. Anyways, this is saying, as I said, you can't allow emotion to say, I'm going to make, let's say these guys are both my sons, which they're not. But Nate's older, Andrew's younger, Andrew's taller. I like that. I'm going to give him firstborn status. Sorry, Nate. The law says, no, Frank, you're not allowed to do that. Nate was the firstborn. Give him the firstborn status. Okay, that seems pretty simple. Are there any circumstances where you would legally lose firstborn status? It doesn't say so here, but there is one example that leads us to think perhaps. What's that? I wasn't thinking about that. I don't know who would, but anybody think of it? There's one example in the Bible. Reuben. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. Did he get the birthright? No. And Jacob says specifically why in Genesis 49, verse 4, he committed adultery with one of Jacob's concubines. See, shouldn't have had more than one wife. So that seems to be a committing a crime, perhaps as well as a sin, and for that, Reuben was disqualified. Not because of emotion, at least not purely. Now, we're reading into the example, but I think it's at least worth considering that. Hopefully, like I said, we don't practice polygamy. It's not an issue for us. But what is an issue is, okay, be fair. Don't let your emotion, don't play favorites. You know, I'm a counselor at camp. I might like some kid in my dorm better than another kid. I shouldn't show favoritism. You got to base things on merit. Sorry, I got camp on the brain lately. So let's move on. Going down to verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and a rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother when they've chastened him, so they go to correct the child first and he won't heed, what's the next step? Father and mother drag him down to the elders and they say, this son of ours is stubborn, rebellious, he won't obey, not to mention he's a glutton and a drunkard and he smells bad. The smell bad I added. But this is leading to the death penalty. All the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones and put away evil from among you. This, again, is pretty harsh. Although this is addresses sons, some scholars say it makes sense that it would apply to daughters as well. Something it also doesn't say, but it implies that this child is old enough to have a mature understanding of his behavior, particularly since it mentions being a drunkard. You don't have many seven-year-olds who are drunkards. You have someone who's old enough to have gone through puberty and acting like an adult. And so then this might be a case. We covered this morning that you have to have at least two witnesses. The word of one person can't put someone to death. So in this case, father and mother. And how many times are you going to have a mother willing to say, my son's a drunkard and all this, stone him? Pretty rare. You know, my experience, the love of a mother surpasses an awful lot, as I think it should. Yeah, Charlie?
In some Jewish stuff, writings, that it was just used as, this law was used as a deterrent, and there's no record of it actually ever happening.
Yeah, there's not a record in Scripture. And I would say, we know the hope of the resurrection would still be there for any punished. But it would provide a strong deterrent. If it were enacted just once, I'm sure all the other teenagers in the village would pay very close attention. You know, I'm going to be careful how I treat mom and dad. I don't want to be stoned. So I think deterrent is far and away the more reason this is in there. Okay, carrying on from that in verse 22, if a man has committed a sin deserving of death and he's put to death and you hang him on a tree... Notice this is saying he's put to death and then hang him on a tree. Execution by hanging developed later on. But it's talking about displaying the body as a deterrent. Hey, look what happens if you do this. Well, God's saying, if you can do that, but the body shall not remain overnight. You shall surely bury him on that day so you don't defile the land. God is saying you can display the body as a deterrent, but one day is plenty of that. Bury it. Okay? By the way, we understand that's the reason when Christ, well, I think at least part of the reason, Christ and the criminals next to him were crucified, the Pharisees say, hey, sun's going down, we got to get those bodies in the grave. They were aware of this. This is cited in Galatians 3, verse 13, where it says, for a body, anyone that's hanged on a tree, it's a curse. So Paul is referring to this law too. So, and I think that's valid, like I said. And by the way, it's worth remembering, in ancient times, this wasn't heeded. I mentioned, if you've seen the movie Braveheart, William Wallace at the end gets You know, I'm glad they don't show all the gruesome details, but you know he's getting disemboweled and he's going to be executed. He was drawn and quartered, but his head was hung on the gates of London and stayed there for years. Ugh. That's gross, yeah. So God does not condone that. I can't talk anymore. So let's move on. I don't know if I'm going to get through my three chapters this hour. We continue on with what is a lot of scholars call sundry laws. Again, miscellaneous laws that, you know, are protecting, you know, human interactions, you know, especially property. Verses 1 through 4, if you see your brother's ox, his sheep, whatever, going astray, well, bring it back. You know, and if you don't know whose it belongs to, you know, set up a lost and found so people can come looking for their property. I mean, it doesn't say it in those words, but that's the idea. You don't know who it is, you take it. God does not believe in the age-old proverb of finders, keepers, losers, weepers. That might work on the playground, but God says, you find something, give it back to whom it belongs to. You know, and you could even make an effort to get it to them. God also wants us to show compassion for animals. Verse 4, you shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down and hide yourself or ignore it. Help them up. You know, so God has compassion for even animals. You see an animal struggling, give it a hand. You know, help it up. Even if it belongs to your enemy. Nowadays, we might say, if you see someone pulled over on the side of the road with a flat tire, and you look, oh, they don't have a jack. I got one in my trunk, but I don't like that guy. You know, I'm going to drive on and see if someone else helps him. God's saying, no, don't be that way. That's not a perfect analogy. And by the way, nowadays, if you see someone pulled on the side of the road, you know, not, and you don't know who it is, a lot of times it's safer to call 911 and ask the sheriff so that it doesn't turn out someone's going to pull a gun and, you know, do something bad to you. So keep in mind, we want to use common sense and safety in how we apply these things to our situations. Verse 5, a woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor a man put on a woman's garment. That's an abomination. I think we've covered this somewhat before. Where do I have it? This doesn't list any particular garment. It doesn't say a woman can't wear pants, although it's been interpreted that way. It seems to be making the point that God does not go for cross-dressing. Transvestites don't fit in God's plan. A man should look like a man, a woman should look like a woman. Don't try to pass yourself off as something you're not. And that's the basis of it. Verse 6 and 7. Provide for simple humanity and kindness, we could say. If a bird's nest happens to be before you on the tree, in a tree or in the ground, and there's young ones or eggs and the mother, okay, you can take the eggs but not the mother. Let the mother go. Why? What do you guys think? Why should I only take the eggs or the young and I got to let the mother go? Okay, the mother can make more eggs. But if I till the mother, what's going to happen to the eggs or the young chicks? You know, they're going to die without the mother to take care of them. So God's saying, look, you know, help preserve the species and show kindness. Don't kill both. And if you're going to take one, make sure you take, you know, the one that can't reproduce. Okay, verse 8. When you build a new house, or you shall make a parapet for your roof that you don't bring blood guiltiness. This is one we've used example before. Now, we don't have flat roofs, but that's what it's referring to. If you've got a living space, put a guardrail up. The best analogy here is if you've got a deck off your backyard and it's elevated, put a railing up so someone doesn't go out there, he's having a beer watching the sunset, and he falls over and breaks his neck. You know, so show common sense and responsibility. You know, and that would apply in other things. You know, if you're mopping the floor, put up one of those yellow signs that says wet floor so people don't fall and kill themselves. Yeah, anyways. Sorry, I was thinking of something funny that wouldn't be funny to you. We get into some things that we saw before. Verse 9 is a repeat of Leviticus 19, verse 19. Forbidding mixing different types of seed. Don't sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed be defiled. Mixing these different types of seeds might have been part of a pagan ritual. We're not certain. Some people say it might be God wanting to prevent cross-pollinization that's not on purpose? To be honest, we're not certain exactly why this is there, because now we have deliberate hybridization of crops. Some would cite this to say, oh, any hybrid crop is wrong and evil, but others would say, no, I'm not sure that's what God is getting at. And to be honest, I'm not a crop scientist, so I'm not certain. I don't see a problem with eating whatever corn I find at the grocery store. Anyways, we'll move on, because a lot of these we've covered before. Verse 10, don't plow with an ox and a donkey together. What's an obvious reason for that? They work differently. Putting them together could be considered cruelty to animals. They won't work well together. The donkey is weaker. The donkey has a different stride, so they can't pull evenly. You're liable to work one to death. I read some accounts, they say, plus donkeys were comfortable eating certain weeds that oxes wouldn't and gave them offensive breath to the ox. And they're yoked together and the donkey has bad breath and the ox is like, oh, that's terrible. He's going to be trying to pull away, and again, they're not working well together. So, and this helps make understandable the analogy Paul used in 2 Corinthians 6:14. 2 Corinthians 6:14, remember, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. I think Paul had this in mind, and he's saying we can take the analogy to other areas. Don't stick two people or two things together that can't work well together. No, again, like I said, I've got summer camp on my brain. For the last several years, when we were looking at people who's coming to camp who want to be counselors, you know, Mr. Martin and Mrs. Fenchel and I would get together and discuss, well, who do we think would work well together? And maybe these two would make a good pair. These two might not work as well together. And, you know, it's a similar type of thing, although we didn't read this scripture and say, oh, don't put a donkey and an ox together. Anyways, let's move on. Verse 11, don't wear a garment of different sorts of wool and linen mixed together. That repeats Leviticus 19, verse 18. And we covered this before. It seems to be primarily saying to avoid mixing animal or protein fiber with plant or vegetable fiber. You know, for maybe a number of reasons. To avoid creating an inferior garment that looks better than it is. To avoid, some people talk about building up static electricity. We're not certain, you know, there are various reasons, none of which that say you can't have a cotton polyester shirt, which I think this one might be. So it's not about not mixing anything, but certain things shouldn't be mixed. Okay, verse 12 repeats the command first found in Numbers 15, verses 37 to 39. Although I will make note, some scholars have said, no, it's not quite the same, because they'll say here, and Deuteronomy is referring to blankets and shawls, whereas Numbers, that was Numbers 15, 37 to 39, refers to garments like clothing. Because it says, make tassels on the four corners of your clothing with which you cover yourself. There are a number of explanations of what this means and who it was for. Most of the possible explanations don't come to the conclusions that Christians have to have tassels on their clothing today. Some do. Now, I personally don't think those are correct. One explanation that I don't think I mentioned when we were in Numbers was that in the Middle East, elaborate hems and fringes with tassels were often a sign of royalty. And so God was making the point, you guys aren't slaves anymore, you can have those ornate things on your garment. Okay, that's a possibility, although I think that one's maybe a stretch. Another interpretation says that this applies specifically to prayer shawls. You know, you have the Jews still today wear those, and they've got four corners, and they can put tassels on those. We don't use prayer shawls. The other one is, and by the way, this is the answer that I think is correct that we as a church point out, is that when this command was first given in Numbers 15, it follows directly after the incident of a man deliberately disobeying the law. You're gathering sticks on the Sabbath. And so God commands him to be put to death and then says, put these tassels so that you can look at them and remember the law. And so we think that was the purpose that was given to Israel. But since we have the Holy Spirit to help us remember the law, and we say that because Christ very specifically said, the Holy Spirit will bring back to your memory the things I said, John 14, 26. That leads us to say Christians aren't required to have tassels on our garments. We have, sometimes said, "What if you really want to wear tassels, you can, but don't go around telling other people that they have to do it or else they're not Christian." And I would point out, and I say this because I remember, this was years and years ago, I don't even remember the fellow's name, but there was a fellow on the staff at summer camp who, partway through, I found out he was wearing tassels. And I didn't know because he kept them tucked in. They were hidden. And my point would be, well, if you're keeping them hidden, how can you look at them and it reminds you of the law? That's kind of defeating the purpose. So if you're wearing tassels, they should be out for everyone to see, especially for you to see. Anyways, I don't want to spend more time on it than necessary. That's part of the reason I'm talking fast. The other part is because I always do and I'm drinking coffee. Okay. And I would like to get through at least two chapters if I don't get three. Where were we? Oh, okay, yeah, we get some verses 13 through 21. And I'm going to summarize here because I'll make the point the law here is focused on condemning fornication. Now, that's the intent, is you're not supposed to have sex before marriage, and it could be punished with the death penalty. It focuses on the women, and I'd say that's unfortunate because God's law forbids sexual immorality in men as well as women, but it's set up saying if a guy marries a woman and then says, "Ha, she wasn't a virgin when I married her," the parents can, it sets up this opportunity to say, well, their parents can bring the evidence. The old King James says tokens of her virginity and show them to the judge and say, "This guy is trying to ruin my daughter's name." And the question comes up is like, what's this evidence of virginity that they're talking about? And we connect it to verse 17. It says, they'll bring it and spread the cloth before the elders. That's led most people who read it to think it's talking about bed sheets. And the idea that if, well, and one of the reasons there's some people argue against this, it's not uncommon for when a woman loses her virginity for there to be some blood loss. But it's not always so. But the people who say it's talking about the bed sheets would say that seems to be it. Others say, well, I don't know what it is. In any case, if the guy is making a false accusation, okay, here's evidence, you're a false accusation. They don't put him to death, but they do take him, it says they'll punish him, verse 18. In verse 19, they'll fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman because he brought a bad name. You know, and she'll, and by the way, he's still stuck with this woman that he doesn't like. He's not allowed to divorce her. So there's, again, the deterrent factor. You know, if there's any chance you're lying about this dude, you're going to suffer. So, you know, you don't want to do this. On the other hand, if the thing is true, evidence of virginity are not found, they'll bring the young woman to the door and they'll stone her with stones because she's done a disgraceful thing. Ah. Again, I remind us, we're a church, not a civil government, so we don't have responsibility to enact these laws. And if I did, I'd say, I'd like to find a system for it to apply to men as well as women. This was a male-dominated society, and that's the way it worked. I'm not using it to say that men should have power that women don't. That's probably as much as I need to say on that. We move ahead, verses 28 and 29. No, wait a minute. Did I skip something? Yes, I did. Starting in verse 23. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, betrothed means engaged, but it's treated, once you're engaged, it's a legal commitment. So it's similar to if you're married. Because it says, a man finds her in the city and lies with her, so they have sexual relations, you bring them both out to the gate of the city, stone them, so man and woman with stones. Why? It says the young woman, because she didn't cry out in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife. You'll put away evil. Verse 25, it says, if a man finds the same woman in the countryside and forces her, basically he rapes her, then only the man shall die. Why not the woman? Verse 26, well, because she didn't do anything wrong, it assumes that she cried out. You know, help, help! And there was no one there to save her because they're out in the country. So, basically, it's making a distinction, and I was going to say I like this one. God's law doesn't care if I like it or not, you know, so I should make that clear. But it's saying if you're in the city, people would have heard if she's saying, help, help, this guy's doing, you know, getting me. So they're both presumed guilty. But in the country, the woman is presumed innocent. You know, whether or not she did, you know, So that's, you know, it's court of, there's this presumption the woman would cry out for help and that she wasn't guilty of anything. Oh, by the way, that the fact that I was making the point that if basically when there's adultery occurring, it does make the point that both of them would be put to death. I make that point because we often refer to the story in John chapter 8. Remember where Christ was teaching and they brought a woman. They said, this woman was caught in adultery right in the very act. But they only brought the woman. If the man and woman were caught in the act, both the man and woman are liable for the death penalty. And Christ would have known that, and the Pharisees should have known that as well. That's one reason I think he didn't respond at all in the way they expected. Anyways, let's move on. In verse 28, if a man finds a young woman who's a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her and they're found out, so she's not engaged to someone, basically he's going to have to marry her. The man who lay with her shall give the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver and she shall be his wife because he's humbled her. He's not going to be allowed to divorce her all his days. So basically it's like, I don't want to use that analogy, but you made that commitment. Maybe you weren't, lost control or whatever. You're married, you're going to stay married. No divorce allowed. Now it's worth noting, it doesn't say it here. I believe it's back in Exodus 22, verse 16. Let me double check that. My handwriting's a little vague. There's something interesting that was added. Exodus 22, 16, it says, if a man entices a virgin who's not betrothed and lies with her, he shall pay the bride price for her to be his wife. But there it says, if her father refuses to give her to him, he'll pay the money according to bride price. So, okay, this man forces the woman, the father of the woman has the right to say, I'm not letting my daughter marry that guy. But the guy still has to pay. And that's, I think, partly appropriate, and it's worth noting, I think I mentioned this back in Exodus, that it could be partly providing money to help support her. Because the father refusing to give her in marriage, he might be saying, she might not ever get married if people know this happened. So this is going to help the father saying, I'll take care of her the rest of her life if necessary. Now, that's somewhat implied here, but I think it's a valid thing to consider. Okay, verse 30. Yes, a man shall not take his father's wife, nor uncover his father's bed. That makes a lot of sense. This may relate to the marriage prohibitions that are listed in Leviticus 18. Remember, Leviticus 18 has a list of marriage couplings that are not allowed, but it seems most likely that this might be referring to a man and his stepmother, because it does say his father's wife. It doesn't say his mother. And there's some circumstances where you could almost see this. Say, a man has an aged father, and I'm trying to think of an example without getting weird. Because some of you guys are pretty young. Andrew, you're what, 20? Okay, 21. You're still kind of old. But I say you. Now, maybe I don't want to make this real. What I'm getting at is a man and woman could have a child, and the mother dies. And so the father later on takes another wife. And maybe he's wealthy. Maybe this is what they call a trophy wife. She's much younger. And good looking. And now the old man dad, he's like 68 years old and married to a 30-year-old woman. And old man dad dies, and he's got a son who's almost 30 himself, could say, hey, this is a nice looking woman. She already has all my dad's money. Maybe I want to marry her. Maybe they actually like each other and have a lot more in common than she did with the old man dad. So you could see that as a scenario being possible. But God says, no. You're not allowed to do that. That would be gross. It would uncover his father's bed. So God forbids that. There is an example of that sort of in the Bible. You remember King David when he was really old and he couldn't stay warm, so they found a fair young virgin that they married to him. What was her name? Abishag. Always reminds me of the Genesis song, Abacab, but it's not. Anyways, after David died, Adonijah goes to Bathsheba and says, ask Solomon if I can marry her. You know, and Solomon has him put to death. Now, partly because they think he's scheming to try to get the crown after all, but there's also a scripture in the Old Testament law that says you're not allowed to do that. So, who knows? Interesting. You guys keeping up? Am I talking way too fast? We are doing a repeat of a lot of the law, so... Okay. Yeah, let's... Since we're in the sundry laws, it's okay if we break partway through a chapter. Although this isn't a fun thing to end on. Chapter 23, he who is emasculated by crushing or mutilation must not enter or shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, nor one of illegitimate birth enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation, none of his ascendants or descendants. Same for an Ammonite or a Moabite. These restrictions are based specifically at men. And it leaves the question, what is the assembly of the Lord? Some people want to say, well, it means ever living in Israel. But I don't think so. You know, especially because you could have some of this happen to you, and does that mean you got to leave the country? Some say it refers to holding some type of public office. You can't be mayor of the town. You're not allowed to be a judge or an elder. Possibly. But assembly... Some people say it might refer to some type of representative body where the leaders from all the nation get together occasionally to advise the king or the judge. And I lean towards that even though there's not hard evidence of it. I'll make a note when it says even to the 10th generation, that might be an idiom in Hebrew for never. You know, it's like if I told you once, I told you 1,000 times, don't do that. It doesn't mean I've literally told you 1,000 times. It means I've said it so many times I'm sick of it. Even to the 10th generation probably doesn't mean once you get to the 11th, everything's fine. It probably means just it's so far you don't even want to count that far. So, and then we go, bell hasn't rung yet. Because I mentioned the same for Ammonite or Moabite. They shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. Why? Because they didn't meet you with bread or water on the road when you came out of Egypt. They hired Balaam against you. Nevertheless, the Lord wouldn't listen to him. I'm making the point there. For them, this was a fairly recent occurrence, as studying it was for us. Before spring break seems like a long, long time ago. But, you know, this, okay, they're saying, hey, remember that thing that happened a couple months ago? That was bad. Don't be involved with those guys. Now, the question came up when we covered the book of Ruth, does it mean no descendants of any Ammonite or Moabite? The more interpretation is that it means that the applies to the men, as the whole thing about crushing or mutilation did. Because we know Ruth was a Moabitess, and her descendants, within 10 generations, there was David, and he in the government. So we don't think it means... exactly that, you know, there seems to be some qualifications on it, which we discussed, and I did hear the bell ring. Just in verse 6, don't seek their peace or prosperity all your days forever. I just want to clarify, because all forever in this case seems to mean as long as these conditions exist, because Christ, in the Sermon on the Mount, said, love your enemies, bless those who curse you. You know, so there seems to be a time when, okay, these qualifications according to race no longer apply. Let me give you one more scripture and then I'll stop. Ephesians 2, verse 19. Ephesians 2, 19, speaking of the church, says, you're no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints. So once you're called into the church, it doesn't matter if you're an Ammonite, Moabite, Girgashite, Hivite, Jebusite, any kind of ite, you're all Christians together. And that's what really counts. So I'm looking for my post-it note. Oh, there it is. So we'll pick up from there next week when we